Andrea Altamore from Washington State. A lot of you saw me yesterday in the Surveillance and Informatics Workshop, so welcome back. This is our panel, appropriately Alaskan named.
There we go.
Jillian's using the down arrow key. How inventive. So I'm going to be taking off my RCKMS team member's hat a little bit and putting on my Washington State hat and trying to talk about what the implications are of RCKMS for those of us who are working at state, local, territorial, and tribal jurisdictions. So for those of you who might not know what RCKMS is, and I bet everybody does here, but it never hurts to refresh, it is the Reportable Conditions Knowledge Management System. It's just too long to say that all the time. It is an authoritative, you can read, real-time portal, enhanced disease surveillance by providing comprehensive information to reporters and others about who, what, when, where, and why, and how of reporting to public health. So everybody knows we've got lots of challenges in reporting. Reporters can't easily access reporting requirements. There's no single place to find them. There's no single way of getting updates when they change. And they're scattered across various websites in various formats. So it's a challenge for our partners in the reporting community. In addition, our reporting requirements are complex. They also change. And most fun of all, they vary among jurisdictions. They're, as a result, not easy to automate. Even without those complexities, they're not readily available in machine-processable format. So RCKMS attempts to address some of those challenges by providing some benefits: easier access to reporting specifications via a single portal that provides real-time information from which reporters can either go and retrieve, or they can automatically receive updates from machine to machine. A single authoring interface for jurisdictions to manage requirements. You're going to hear a lot more about that later. Base content, a pre-populated set of sort of default requirements so that you don't start with a blank slate. You start with something that you can edit to fit your own jurisdiction's needs. It enables easier automation of reporting by providing machine processable specifications. We'll talk more about that. It's been a really long time coming. The public health knowledge base was back, an article published back in 2005, and it went through several iterations. The ELR task force prioritized creating RCKMS as one of its closing recommendations, recognizing that the reportable conditions mapping tables were only a building block for a more comprehensive system, and then initial work on RCKMS began in 2012. So how does RCKMS fit in with ECR? If you were in the workshop yesterday, you know that that's an interesting question. And this is one of the current models. We used to have a little pointer. Yesterday we had a little ability to have a pointer on the screen. So not today, because we're recording. But basically, I'm going to point at the screen then. On your left is the electronic health record that sends in initial case report to a shared services platform, which then sends it to RCKMS, which then enhances it by checking to see whether, based on the information in the report, it constitutes a reportable event in one or more jurisdictions, and then let's send it back so that it can be sent to public health if it's reportable, and then back to the EHR with that notice of reportability. In this little diagram, EICR plus is EICR plus the notice of reportability, the information that RCKMS adds. And that center chunk with the shared services and RCKMS in current model is the public health community platform. But an alternative vision might be where RCKMS provides knowledge in a standard format to EHRs, and EHRs act on that knowledge and provide the EICR to public health. Public health obviously provides the knowledge in the first place. So that's an alternate model. It's one we envisioned at the beginning of the RCKMS project, and it has evolved. And RCKMS also addresses the needs of ELR, and since ELR is not, labs are not using EICR, they're not using the platform kind of in the same way, in general we envision that RCKMS will provision knowledge to laboratories and they will incorporate it in their own systems to generate ELRs. So we started out with a pilot last year with a variety of partners that you can see there, including reporters and jurisdictions. There was content development on four conditions and some early development on trigger codes, which we'll talk more about lots more during this meeting, and developing some scalable processes to continue to develop content because this is a big job. There was a bunch of technical development. Thank you very much, those of you in the room who've been doing that, including the authoring interface, the machine processable reporting specifications, the development of a public health decision support service. So clinical decision support's been around for a while, public health decision support, kind of just getting started. And then implementing all of these pieces with the pilots. The most recent phase, which is just ending, was to continue the pilot work, to move towards a production-ready version of the tool, and to create default content for a subset of reportable conditions, again, with a large set of partners. And deliverables, again, machine processable reporting specifications and some trigger codes. So we've tried to engage the community with lots of conversations about RCKMS. It seems like we talk about it all the time, but that may just be our perspective. CSD committee calls, annual conferences, including breakout sessions like this, workshops like yesterday, and roundtables. Other venues, national calls for CDC and ONC, AskDonateCho, and work groups, for both for defining the requirements for the tooling and for vetting the content. So the good news about RCKMS is that we will be able to communicate with reporters, requirements for lab reporting and case reporting in both machine human readable and machine processable format form in one place, in a single format based on standards, using terminology and standards for representing rules and knowledge. So that's the good news. So from the perspective of the jurisdiction, you know, what are some of the challenges? Well, effective use of RCKMS is going to require that we in the jurisdictions understand what it is and how it works. Decision support systems are relatively new to public health, except for that one. Expressing rules as logic is not necessarily new to us, but has been a challenge. The position statement tables, I think, are a good example. And we need to be able to understand the construct. That was supposed to say value sets, but it disappeared behind the brain. And including use of standard terminology, some of which are more familiar to us, like SNOMED and ICD, and some of which are a little less familiar in the public health community, like RX norm for medications. So some additional challenges. Effective use requires mastery of new tools. Talked about the RCKMS authoring software. We're going to talk a lot more about it. In order to use that tool effectively, you have to understand how to use the base content, what it comprises, and how you can manipulate it for your own jurisdictional needs. You need to build business processes in your jurisdiction for authoring, for review and authorization of the content, and for publishing and for continually revising the content. So this is a whole new workflow for public health jurisdictions that will be necessary. So some more challenges. Supplying content the first time around, when you first get your jurisdictional content into RCKMS, it's going to be a new way of expressing your jurisdictional requirements. You've got to collect the information, identify the gaps, close the gaps based on what RCKMS is going to ask you to provide, and then work towards modifying the base content. So a lot of jurisdictions have pieces of this built around doing SRCA, but it's going to be a more complex process. And then the work is never done. As you know, the world keeps changing, conditions and diseases change, populations change, the science of doing public health and medicine changes, politics change, different things become hot topics, and therefore resources change, and jurisdictional rules change. So content in RCKMS is not static. Oops. So one question is RCKMS the truth? Is it the one true way? We've got lots of information out there in jurisdictional websites and all. So what happens when the answer in RCKMS is different from what it says on your jurisdictional website? Is there such a thing? What's a reporter legally required to do in that situation? And is there such a thing as intentional discrepancies? Can and should they exist? So when I talk about intentional discrepancies, what I'm talking about is a difference between what RCKMS will do initially, which is a subset of what all possible criteria for reporting might represent, focusing on demographic, laboratory, and diagnostic slash problem criteria, and what RCKMS will do eventually, which is expand beyond that. to, for example, clinical symptoms and medications prescribed. So initially in that first stage, RCKMS will have a subset of criteria available, and what's on a jurisdictional website may be different. It's a pain point that I think we need to think about. So another challenge is variations on that big picture I showed. So some jurisdictions may be legally unable or unwilling to have reports come through a national platform. So a solution that presupposes a national platform may not work for some of us. Similarly, they may be legally unable to or not willing to participate in RCKMS. I heard a comment yesterday about, I don't want RCKMS to decide what's reportable to me. So again, there's not necessarily going to be consensus on this. And each jurisdiction is going to have to decide what role RCKMS is going to play for you. Some more challenges. Reducing variation. Those of you who heard me talk at previous CST meetings know this is one of my hobby horses. So why does variation exist? Why don't we all have, you know, one uniform set of national criteria for reporting? And since we don't have it, if we think variation is a bad thing, how far are we willing to go to minimize it? Some reasons why variation in reporting requirements exist are here. Local incidence and prevalence of conditions vary, available resources, political interests and mandates vary. You make different assessments of the need for public health action in a specific situation and therefore the need for surveillance. And different need for or desire for denominator data, like getting all results for, let's say, blood lead screening, which we do in Washington State, as opposed to only elevated. And all of those are valid reasons why you might want to do things differently in your jurisdiction than in another jurisdiction. So what do we do about it? Do we agree that less variation is better? And as we've talked about this over the years, there's certainly a difference of opinion about that. So, whoa, this slide didn't get sized up, so I apologize for that. We had some trouble with our slide template. So implications of variation, I'll read this more or less to you. Some kinds of variation are harder for computers to deal with than others. So it's easy if you've got a different threshold, for example, for reporting for blood lead, 5 micrograms per deciliter versus 10. Easy for a computer to handle that. Some things are a little harder, like, and these are chosen from our own rules in Washington State, herpes simplex genital initial infection only. Well, determining what's an initial infection, not so easy necessarily. And similarly, influenza novel or unsubtypable, the little strain, what's novel is going to change. Something that was novel last year, I mean, H1N1 was novel a while back, and now it's just part of the package. So it's hard for computers to deal with reporting requirements that are expressed in that way. Ah, golly gee. Okay, so there's a couple of ways to deal with variation. Sorry, slide didn't adjust again. One is to accommodate it, and we do that in RCKMS by allowing for jurisdictional specific reporting criteria. The other end of the continuum is to kind of relax our rules on our jurisdictional side to say, you know, if we all get along and we say we're all going to adhere to one set of criteria in this particular instance, then I may get some things that I don't really want. And is there a process that if I receive something like that, I can e-shred it and say, you know, but therefore make it easier for reporters because we're having more uniformity. So that's one. Those are two ways of accommodating variation. Another way is to try to, well, fix variation, to come to an agreement that we will adhere to a single set of criteria in a particular instance. And we've had some experience with people coming to consensus in content vetting sessions, and Ryan was going to talk a lot more about that. So in my view, from the perspective of a jurisdictional public health agency, RCKMS offers great promise. Gosh, this computer, sorry. But realizing that promise will require change. And we know that change is going to come, as I said, in knowledge, in practice, in policies, and maybe in our law and rule. That's the scariest part for me, because You know, when thinking about that, I have to think about how much is desirable and how much is necessary and even how much is possible. You all are dealing with the same situation as, you know, as us, which is, this is not us. I mean, we don't just sort of wave our magic wand and make this happen. You're not supposed to read this. This is just an example of where our what our Washington Administrative Code says. But we don't even own, the Board of Health owns our rules, and so we have to go through, as all of you do, a pretty large and complicated public process to change reporting criteria. So again, another bottom line, but from CSDE's perspective, at least as I see it, that the benefits will outweigh the challenges its use will present, and that we're also working to help jurisdictions make effective use of this new tool. You heard yesterday something, some parts about companion guides and toolkits, and so I guess the bottom line for me is we're not alone in doing this. And I will stop there. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Rita. My name is Ryan Arnold. I'm with the Houston Health Department. I've been working with the RCKMS project for the last about a little over two years now. And for the last year, we've been developing content for the RCKMS tool, which is what I'm going to go through here. We kind of split it up into, I'll do the knowledge component, the actual content that goes into the tool, and Daryl will follow it up with going over the technical components of the tool. So if I quickly go over some of the technical components, don't worry, you'll hear more about it. And I want to start off with an Alaska joke here. This is Sarah Palin seeing Russia from her house, of course. And the analogy here is that RCKMS, you know, we're going to need it here pretty quick. We have meaningful use, stage three approaching in 2018 for ECR. And RCKMS is a tool that we envision to make this transition into Meaningful Use 3 much easier, much better for the jurisdictions, much better for the healthcare providers as well. But we still have some work to do. We still have content development that's still ongoing. We have some technical development that's still ongoing. We still need to move it to production. We have to onboard jurisdictions. And finally, we're going to look at performance and security enhancements for RCKMS in order to best meet the jurisdiction's needs. But finally, the goal is to envision and realize RCKMS. So I think most of us are familiar with these. These are how we currently communicate with healthcare providers about what is reportable. These include not only the conditions, but, you know, as Rita was mentioning, maybe you only want the initial reports, or maybe, such as HIV, you want every single document that comes up for the condition. And these are usually found on websites, they're found on papers, and we largely rely on healthcare providers to know these things, right? And I don't know if what your experience has been, but our experience has been that providers don't necessarily know all these things. So moving forward, we want RCKMS to automate a lot of those processes. So here's the schematic of how RCKMS is envisioned to work with healthcare and public health. On the left, you have healthcare. In the middle third, you have an EHR. And the right third, you have RCKMS service. On the left, we have a record encounter in an EHR, which matches to a set of trigger codes. So the first step for the content development is we need to know what are those trigger codes that are going to trigger a report into the RCKMS service. And if that matches trigger codes, that generates an initial case message into the RCKMS service, which is on the right-hand side. And I'm sorry, it's a little bit small for the back. If you guys still have an opportunity to move forward if you'd like. And once it gets into the RCKMS service, then we need to know if it's actually reportable in order to send it into public health. That's where the rules come into play. And a huge focus of what we've been doing for the content vetting and content development process has been understanding what are these rules and how do we establish a national sort of norm and default criteria for reportability. And if that meets reportability, of course, then a message gets sent into public health and a notice of reportability gets sent back to the healthcare provider. And this is just a quick status update of where we are on the content vetting process. I want to note that it's the first round of content vetting, so this is the initial go, and then we take the comments from the content vetting work group and we rework that content, and as it says in the note on the bottom there in small print, some of these conditions may be re-vetted to get additional feedback. But so far, we've done 67 of the 74 conditions, so we're almost there. We do about 2 to 4 weeks, so probably 3 or 4 more weeks, and we'll have it done, at least the initial round. So how do we develop the content? We've adopted, and when I say we, it's a large team that I'm only a very, very small part of. We've adopted an agile approach for project management. And the idea is that we draft specifications with a content development team. We review those specifications with the larger team. We vet that content initially with position statement authors. And a lot of that revolves around, are we understanding what you wrote in the CSTE position statements? Are we understanding the rules that you put in there? Are we understanding the narrative as well as the tables that are used? And finally, we vet the content with the content vetting work group. These are some of our team members, and a number of them are in the audience here. The content product owners are Janet Way with CSTE and Laura Kahn with CDC. And just to note, content product owners, these are just the people who are owning the project, not the actual content. Our Scrum Master is Shuma Garvey, and then we have a number of people that are working on the actual content drafting. But I really want to highlight on the bottom there the content vetting work group. These people have been fantastic. Every week, week in and week out, we have SMEs come on the call, anywhere from 20 to 40, sometimes as many as 50 subject matter experts on the call who are helping us to review the content and to understand if we're capturing what the jurisdictions will need from RCKMS moving forward. So I really want to highlight that they've been exceptional. And anybody in here that's participated, I know I see Annie and a few others that have participated. Thank you so much. You guys have been fantastic. So the content vetting work group, which I'm the chair of for the last several months now, our goal is to vet the proposed content. And again, that's those trigger codes and those reporting specifications for the notifiable conditions. Again, we're focusing on ensuring that criteria meet the needs of most jurisdictions. And we understand that, you know, we're not going to meet 100%. We may not even meet 90% of the needs. But we want to make sure that what we develop is going to be broad enough that the jurisdictions can either adopt it outright or they can adapt it to meet their needs, which we'll go through here in a moment, and Daryl will go through in much more detail. And we're focusing on reviewing the drafted content, which are the clinical diagnoses, the laboratory observations and results, the resources or links related to the reportable conditions, and also the, you know, the codes and the laboratory values that we're actually using in the RCKMS tool. So here's a, sort of a schematic of how we're envisioning our process to work and how it's actually been working for the last almost, I guess about 9 months now. And if you can't see the bottom, we start with the CSTE position statement, and the top step, we get to the logic that's implemented in the RCKMS. And as you'll notice, we have an increasing level of structure and computability as we move from that position statement all the way to the logic that gets implemented in RCKMS. And as you're all aware, this is an example of the section 6 from the position statement. This is kind of the narrative description of what's reportable. So we start with that, and we also start with the table 6B from the position statement. So this is what CSTE has drafted as sort of a national norm for reporting criteria. And a lot of jurisdictions have adopted this outright, which is why we've started here. And then we move that into a consolidated spreadsheet. So what we're doing is we're looking at how do we represent that in a way that we can easily translate into rules for the RCKMS. So just to kind of go through that consolidated spreadsheet a little bit here, this is just a snippet of the Hepatitis B consolidated spreadsheet. On the left, we have criteria. These are split up into things like clinical criteria, laboratory criteria, epidemiology criteria, and vital records criteria. For instance, the healthcare record contains a diagnosis of acute Hep B or detection of hepatitis B IgM antibody. So these are examples of the criteria that we're using to build rules. And on the right-hand side, we have what are called logic sets. These are the actual rules. We've been using the SNO notation that the position statements use. Of course, S is sufficient for reporting. N's and O's, we need all the N's and at least one O for reporting. And then this is just a snapshot of the work group spreadsheet that I think this one is influenza. And I know you're not going to be able to read anything there. Doesn't really matter. Not a big deal. The gist is that the yellow boxes there are comments that we make every week. the red words on the left-hand side are what we have questions about for the work group. So we have very, very directed, specific questions that they help us work through. And on the right-hand side, we answer those questions and we note all of the comments that get brought up on the work group call so we can address those in the future. Some of those questions include, just basically, do the S, N's, and O's accurately reflect reporting requirements? We also have some questions about like the operationalization of some of these rules. How is this going to actually look in reality, and is that going to be what you actually want? We ask about the clinical criteria, the lab criteria, again, some general questions as well as some very, very specific questions that we feel only the SMEs and the jurisdictions could really answer. Then we record all that feedback in the same spreadsheet. And finally, we have a revised spreadsheet that gets published, and in some cases we go back and we need to revet that with the content vetting work group if we've made substantial changes especially. And again, going back to our staircase here, once we have that consolidated spreadsheet, we move over to the clinical rules logic with value sets. Value sets are the codes that make up those criteria. So when you say you have a diagnosis of hepatitis B, well, that's a combination of CPT, ICD-9, ICD-10 codes that say this is hepatitis B and it's acute. So we move those into rules. We have a if-then logic. For instance, if the patient has a diagnosis of acute hep B, or if the patient has a problem list entry of acute hep B, or if the patient has a death record of acute hep B, then go ahead and report that. And then finally, that gets implemented in the RCKMS tool. And these last two steps here, where we go to the clinical rules logic and the logic implemented in RCKMS, I'm just glossing over because Daryl will go through that in much more detail. So some of the challenges with moving to machine processable rules. Many of the requirements are easily converted. You can think of the ICD codes, LOINC codes, SNOMED codes. These are very easy to translate into rules. Some of the requirements are much harder, though. These are non-coded variables such as epidemiology criteria, such as contact with the laboratory confirmed pertussis case. That's not necessarily something we're going to be able to get from an EHR, and we realize that. And that's come up, you know, pretty routinely on the calls, but we still want to capture that information to understand what jurisdictions are asking for, even if we know today that that's not automatable. Some other examples include symptoms that may or may not be coded in the EHR, and also post-coordinated terms that may be qualifiers or abnormal flags. An example of that is paroxysmal, which may just be an abnormal flag, e.g. a qualifier on cough, right? That may not be its own specific code in the EHR. And so once we have logic implemented in RCKMS, the jurisdictions can either adopt or adapt. You can adopt the content outright, and you can use that as your reporting content for your state or your large local jurisdiction, or you can adapt that content to meet the jurisdiction's needs. And we've sort of used the term applying localizations for that process, which I think Daryl will go over in much more detail, but there's definitely an opportunity for jurisdictions to take what we've developed, see what other jurisdictions have developed, and adapt in order to meet the needs of their jurisdictions. Some of the follow-up questions that we've got, will jurisdictions have access to the final spreadsheets, value sets, et cetera? Yes, you know, all these deliverables are being shared as we move forward and once we have those finalized as well. We also get a lot of, you know, my jurisdiction has this condition that's reportable, so will this condition be available within RCKMS? And if it's not on the nationally notifiable conditions list, we will not have it on the initial default criteria, but yes, moving forward, we will have the ability to create content for those diseases that maybe your jurisdiction needs but other jurisdictions don't ask for. Another question, when will the RCKMS tool be ready for jurisdictions to use? And as I mentioned earlier, you know, meaningful use is quickly approaching, and we envision it to be part of electronic case reporting infrastructure, and of course that's going to be in 2018 is when we're going to need to be able to use this. And I kind of wanted to leave us with a quote from Henry Ford, who said, "If I asked the people what they wanted, they would have told me a faster horse." And we don't need faster horses in public health, right? We need innovative thoughts, innovative tools. We need thought leaders to move us forward in the field. So I really want to kind of make that analogy with RCKMS. We're really looking at how do we move reporting from this manual process where we ask laboratories, we ask healthcare facilities, we ask providers to know somehow what's reportable into a system where we can automatically get that information from providers, from laboratories, and use that for the good of the public's health. So I want to thank you.
I want to thank Rita and Ryan for their good presentation. They did a really good lead-in to where I'm going to go now, which is with the RCKMS technology. So what I'm going to do today is really just sort of dive into sort of the details about the RCKMS services and authoring tool that Rita and Ryan both mentioned in their talks. So first I wanted to talk about the thinking behind the RCKMS software, and I think really what it sort of boils down to is three points. We want to sort of build a generalizable suite of software that is based on best practices, it's open source, and it's standards-based. And there's really sort of the three main components to this. There's the Public Health Decision Support Service, which is what we'll be processing ongoing real-time requests about whether or not a case report should be made or sent to public health based on medical records supplied to this Decision Support Service. There's also the easy-to-use authoring tool, and I actually wrote easy-to-use because that really is our primary objective. We really want the tool to be easy to use. I mean, because for as much as I can sit here and talk about how great the technology is, it really does need to be adopted by the jurisdictions in order to be a success. Then finally, the idea that the RCKMS can be integrated with the public health community platform. You know, we've talked about that yesterday during the pre-conference and I'm sure in other talks. But we also want to leave the option that potentially RCKMS could stand on its own from a technology perspective. I'm not talking policy or what will actually happen. So the Public Health Decision Support Service. The first thing to mention is that it's based on open source clinical decision support software called OpenCDS. OpenCDS is, I'm going to read it here, is a multi-institutional collaborative effort to develop scalable CDS tools and resources. And I think what that really means is that they really want to be able to make clinical decision support accessible to as many people as possible. And the tools that they make are going to be aligned with sort of where the standards efforts are going, and will continue to align as the standards evolve and as the technology evolves in clinical decision support. Also, the RCKMS team has been actively collaborating with the OpenCDS team, so we are also involved in that, and as we develop out our tools, the software will kind of try to keep in line with sort of where the best practices are going. Also, the Public Health Decision Support Service, just to kind of build on what I was just saying, we want to sort of lower the barrier to adoption. So this is in line with, again, with the authoring tool. We want to make it as easy as possible to adopt and to foster that interoperability between public health and other clinical decision support clinical systems. Below, I list a few of the standards that are actually being adopted and used by this project, the HL7 Decision Support Service, the HL7 Virtual Medical Record, which is to model the rules, the HL7 Clinical Quality Line, which actually represents a machine-executable version of the rules, and Drools is the technology in which the final representation of the rules is deployed. So other characteristics about the Public Health Decision Support software is that it's a web services architecture, and it's meant to be scalable by volume. So we understand that there could be a lot of volume, and we are designing the software to handle that, as well as sort of by the amount of data that's in the system, whether you think of it in terms of the number of jurisdictions or the conditions. We want it to be conducive for future enhancements. And just very simply, what it does is it evaluates patient data input on a request-by-request basis, determines which jurisdictions are relevant to the request based on the patient's address, where the patient has received care, and or the servicing laboratory, and then executes the appropriate logic. The output of the decision support is the notice of reportability, which is a standard that is being worked on that everyone will align with to indicate which conditions are reportable and to where the case report should be made, and along with other information such as time frame and where to report. The authoring tool is built on top of other open source software, namely the CDS administration tool, or CAT for short. CAT is also open source and has been designed as both an application framework as well as an application itself to manage the CDS logic and deployments. It's modular in architecture, so while it has sort of a base set of features for managing rule logic and value sets and things like that, it also can be extended with a sort of its pluggable architecture to add domain-specific features, for such as immunization forecasting, which is one such plugin that's available now. And it includes that WebUI front end for entering the reporting specifications and the logic. With respect to RCKMS, there are two user views. There's the RCKMS administrator view, which has sort of a lot of functionality and menu items and features available to that administrator, and the jurisdiction view, which is much simpler to use and sort of boiled down to just really hone in on the information needed for the jurisdiction reporting specifications. Finally, it also offers the ability to generate a human-readable view of the reporting specification itself. So this is sort of a diagram of how the authoring tool works. Primarily on the right-hand side, you can see the authoring interface, which is the web application, really sort of stores all that information into a database repository. And then when the time is appropriate, is deployed through an automated mechanism to the decision support service. As Ryan mentioned, there are pre-configured defaults for each condition that are built into the tool, and that the users may adopt the logic as is or modify or adapt them. However, if other sort of underlying data, which is necessary to make the logic work, changes, such as the value sets itself, the authoring tool and the decision support service will automatically account for that change. The jurisdictions do not need to worry about that. And if the guidelines or logic changes itself, then the RCKMS team provides a means for the jurisdictions to update their reporting specifications with the new default logic and to publish them appropriately into their local version of the rules. So this is the example of the reporting specification and what it looks like in the software itself. It really is a rendition of the spreadsheet logic that Ryan showed earlier. On the left here, you have the criteria itself. And that's listed out. So, for example, under the clinical subject line, we have chlamydia is a diagnosis or active problem or mentioned in as text as a cause of death or a significant condition contributing to death. We have the death record, demographic, epidemiologic, and laboratory data below. And then each column to the right are the logic sets. There's only one logic set for laboratories. And then there are two logic sets for the sort of the provider facility related reporters. And if any one column or any one logic set has enough of those N's or S's or O's, really sufficient, necessary, or options combined in such a way, then that case report should be made. Otherwise, it should not. And with respect to the tool itself and using the tool, you can see that these are really just drop-downs, and the user can pretty much just pick and choose what they would like to have included in their logic sets, and they can add and remove logic sets or criteria as needed. So this is sort of the way in which we envision that it would be as easy to use as possible. The authoring tool also has a set of test cases, and so when a jurisdiction pulls down that default view of the reporting specification, it comes bundled in with the test cases that the RCKMS team has looked into or has actually created as a part of the default. And those test cases are really a way for the jurisdictions to be confident that their logic is running correctly. And if they make any changes or they adapt their reporting specification, then they can go ahead and actually add tests, which would help them ensure that the changes they made are actually operating according to the way they expected. Oh, and one last thing I do want to mention is I want to highlight this third bullet here, and that is that the authoring tool allows as a test case entry to actually manually enter test cases through data entry or by accepting an EICR, which is a HL7 CDA standard. And is the payload format that the electronic initial case reports will be made. This is an example of, or this is actually the splash screen for the test case editor, and you can see where the user would enter in the name and the description and other information like the age and execution date and whatnot. And just as a best practice, what we often tell people when they create test cases is that they really should fill out the name and description very carefully and be very clear what's actually in there so they know what's being tested. The reporting specifications can be deployed on a schedule or on demand. They are deployed through a REST service to the Decision Support Service, OpenCDS. The final execution in the Decision Support Service is the rules and the value sets, but there is also an intermediate representation of the rules that is created, which aligns with the HL7 CQL expression logical model format, which helps in sort of the generation of the rules, but will have other sort of possible side effects, such as perhaps the ability to offer the rules or share the rules with others, and to be more technology or platform agnostic if needed in the future. I just have a couple more screens. I know I'm running out of time. This is the administrator functions that are available to the RCKMS administrators. So I mentioned, this is not really what the jurisdictions deal with, but you have things like code systems and concepts and value sets. All of these things can be managed through this interface. There's also the ability to manage data models. So right now we're using the HL7 virtual medical record for the modeling of the rules, but we could use something else differently if that were ever desired. And then right here, finally, I have an example of what an actual rule, this is an actual criteria, and what it looks like in the authoring tool. So this is the logic behind the criteria that you see in the grid. And this particular criteria indicates how detection of C. trachomatis, chlamydia trachomatis by nucleic acid by any method in a clinical specimen. This indicates the logic behind that. And you can see how the value sets and the concepts are being used through this pretty simple predicate structure. So I'll leave it to Laura to the next steps.
I thought that slide was out of there, but not so much. So I just wanted to take a couple of minutes in closing and both thank our panelists for their leadership and the full team. This is a fantastic team, and the effort by CSTE, both at the national office and the membership, to move this project forward in the last couple of years has been amazing. think you can see the progress that's been made there. I think from CDC's perspective, we're very excited about moving this forward into the next phase, integrating RCKMS, the technology, into the shared services platform and having an operational system. We need to do that. We will have two things coming up that in the next phase to, you've heard about them both, one is authoring, and that's where you will be much more engaged in the next year. And one of the things I'm very excited about is that we anticipate at the PHI conference in August having the system available for you to sit with us and have some hands-on time. So I encourage you to, when you get back home, think about what that looks like. We'll be getting some information out to you about what conditions and what specifications, but to come to that with those so you can sit with us and learn, and we can learn from you how we can make this system work for you. And then as we put this onto the system, having those initial implementations of the decision support tool, so exercising it so we can see when an initial case message or that data comes in, what the output is, and that we are assuring that as you author rules, it's getting the answer that you want, and that those would result in case reports that you want coming to you. So we're in the steps of sort of finalizing the planning for the next phase as we finalize funding for the work to continue with CSTE. The last thing I wanted to mention, just in your thinking about coming with the specifications to author, is we've had a few conversations about reorienting our thinking about when you want lab reports and when you want electronic case reports. And I think that sometimes it's easy for us to flip back because we've had the experience of lab reports, and when we say, do you want a case report about that, we get varying answers. And we'll keep reminding you, and we keep reminding ourselves because of our experiences based in ELR, but we really do want you to start thinking about, if there's a potential case of this, and especially if there's lab data, do I really want a full case report, or do I want an initial case report, let's say that, to be identified and sent to me? So we'll be patient with us as we continue to ask those questions, because we're learning what you want, and we're learning how to represent that in the system so that you do get lab reporting when you want lab reporting and case reporting as it advances when you want a case report. So thank you very much. Thank you for the panel.
Okay, thank you, Daryl, Rita, and Ryan, for that great presentation. It's really a tremendous amount of work that's been going on. We do have quite a bit of time for questions, but as moderator, I'm going to take advantage of the fact that I have the microphone right now. So I actually have a couple of questions. So in order to make sure that everybody has an opportunity to come up, please take the microphone, otherwise I'll just hog it. So first of all, in terms of quality assurance activities, once the sets are in play, how are you planning to have ongoing quality assurance activities rolled into the maintenance of this?
Sure, but then I'm going to pass it to Daryl for the
technical response. I mean, we are working, and I mean, it is somewhat of a technical response. I mean, I think what we're working to do is ensure that we have a system that can represent what your reporting specifications request, and that we can make, and we can get that into a system that can be computable. But then we do have to have a exerciser, they call it a test manager, that will put those scenarios in and see if we get the results that we want. And so getting from you what those scenarios are, and especially the complex ones, so to make sure that the output is indeed what you expect, will be a process that we have to go back and forth with the jurisdictions. It's going to be specific to your jurisdictions as your jurisdiction requirements are, especially in the ones where there are variations, so that we can ensure that what comes out of the system is indeed what you want. So
it will be an ongoing process, and as Rita says, as things change, we'll need to continue to exercise that and make sure that we have a very good set of test cases that ensures for each condition you're getting what you want.
So is it anticipated that each jurisdiction will be developing their own set of use cases that will be given to the RCKMS technical team that will be run on an ongoing basis?
I'm not sure about use cases, but I wanted to expound a little bit on what Laura said, and that is that about the test cases, this may be related to the question you're asking, and that is that the test cases will be very comprehensive, provided by the RCKMS team, and sort of if that is just a detail-oriented exercise that the team has to undertake to make sure that the logic is appropriately tested so that you can be confident about the logic out of the box. If a jurisdiction tries to adapt or change the test cases, then we can talk about how this team can help all of you, but really I think what that means is that the jurisdiction then also has to double check the test cases and make sure that they write some of their own test cases to make sure that the logic changes are operating the way we anticipated. So I think that that's a very important, but there may be things that we can do from a tooling perspective to make it more clear, what are the criteria that changed and maybe some of the edges that needed to be dealt with because of those changes. And then also I'll just add, I think that there's also and this really is just maybe an onboarding issue, but there's also working, I think, with the reporters and really understanding their data, and that as the data comes in, that we have the right rules. The rules represented, not the right rules, but the rules represented in a way that it is represented or in the payload or in the EICR message itself, so that we don't think that the rules are operating correctly on their data when really they maybe are representing something in a way we didn't expect.
And I also want to point out, I don't know who made it to the session yesterday on ECR, but Daryl gave a demonstration of actually submitting test cases, whether that's through CDA or through the preloaded test cases, and it's something that jurisdictions can do on their own. It seems to be very user-friendly, so I think there's a lot of opportunity for jurisdictions to conduct a lot of that testing and QA on their own, as well as relying on the test cases that RCKMS is developing.
Daryl, can you reiterate the two
What Shu was asking is what are the sort of to reiterate the two different ways in which test cases can be executed in the RCKMS, and that there's really two different ways. One is actually by submitting your own CCDA message. I know that a lot of jurisdictions are receiving CDA messages from their providers. You can actually take that information and pass that into RCKMS and see what answers it gives you. That's one way to do that, and probably automated tools can be built to do that sort of in a sort of handle a lot of different volume to do that. And then the other way to do the test cases is to data enter the values or the input that you would want to send into the service if you're trying to emulate your own set of patient data, and then what the expected output is for the from the RCKMS service itself. And the output is really on two levels, right? Is this based on the patient data information being passed in, is this reportable or not for the specified condition? And then also, what criteria do you think would be met? The criteria that is in that left-hand side of the grid, what criteria would be met by the patient data being passed in? So you really sort of get that little extra
level of assurance by making sure that each individual criteria is or is not met, and you can be fairly confident that, that things are operating the way you expected or would expect it to.
I'm Rachel Wiseman, I'm from Texas.
I don't think it's on.
It should be right.
I'm Rachel Wiseman. I'm from the Texas Department of State Health Services, and I have two questions. My first is, can you maybe specify a little bit more the timeline? Because some of your description sounds very hypothetical or theoretical, and some of it sounds like it's done. So I'm a little confused, and I need more than just 2018. So you can answer that first.
I think our immediate next steps are within the next couple of months. In fact, we're in the process of integrating the initial tools into a shared services platform, the AIMS platform that APHL has, and we'll be doing that integration testing, and then it's by August, the end of the summer, have the offering tool available to you guys to start working in and offering your rules for a limited set of conditions, probably about four conditions to start with, and I'll let, then we'll have a cycle where additional conditions are added, and we will be interacting with you so that you can get your specific rules for those conditions in as the base or default criteria is put in there. And then we'll be working in the context of the broader ECR activities in order to pilot and do initial implementation of exercising the tool and the decision support component of our CKMS to support electronic issues.
Does that help, Rachel?
Yeah.
Great.
And so then my second question is, so I'm here, I'm from the program side, as I say, the person from Texas, and we don't really have IT or informatics staff, and then we have the folks that do MBS, and they would not be able to take this on as another project. So how would you suggest basically a state that, as far as I can tell, is not interested in this or is unaware of it, perhaps, besides the program people who barely understand what you're saying? So, like, can you, you know, what's the big picture here? How do we, at our end, or how does CSE at their end make that work? Anybody? And this is not just our CKMS, I mean, it's ECR together, really.
Well, I'm not going to talk about ECR, no. But I will talk about our CKMS, and from my perspective, it's exactly people like you who will be sitting with your hands at the keyboard doing the authoring, because you're the ones who know what the reporting criteria for your conditions are. So from a, check me if I'm wrong, guys, but from my perspective, from the jurisdiction view, it's not an IT investment. It's a knowledge investment. And but ECR is a very different thing.
I mean, we can test the system, but how do we get someone to put something in it, and a provider, a real entity?
That's ECR.
Gotcha. So it's a larger ECR question.
Right. So where's the session where they answer those questions? Because they didn't let us ask it yesterday.
I think it's
I mean, there's going to be an incentive for providers to adopt Meaningful Use 3, right? Meaningful Use has always been an economic incentive. You know, a lot of informatics, I think, needs to start being driven by a business case. And I think we need to start driving it now through a business case. We need to understand where are the hospitals, how is it benefiting them as far as their business goes, as far as, and also for us. I mean, we spend a lot of resources. I know, you know, we see a lot of jurisdictions just in this room, and those jurisdictions are each receiving faxes, they're receiving ELRs, they're receiving phone calls. And this is time, this is personnel resources. So we need to start understanding how does informatics help us as a business case. I think that's a good place to start for understanding how to make that case to either your Texas Department of Health or Department of State Health Services or to the hospitals that you're servicing within your region.
And if I could just add to that, I mean, I think that, you know, there are conversations that are happening at the national level through CDC, that CDC is convening, that are bringing vendors to the table, and we'll be getting their, you know, commitment to participate in this effort to support public health reporting. Bill, did you want to add anything to that?
Thank you, Julian. So let me turn around. So, yes. Exactly. What's going to happen is there's going to be a large opportunity for communication. Clearly, there are states that are not ready. There are states that are more capable of taking on the first pilots for electronic case reporting. And those are the coalition of the willing and the capable will begin the process of taking it on, doing the first projects, helping us figure out where the problems are, solving them, and creating a pathway for the rest of the states to go forward. Now, you know, a lot of there's going to need to be workforce and resources for states to do this. It's going to take time. It's not going to happen overnight. So there's going to be a large communication effort that will happen over time bring people up to speed and to get state health officials to understand what this is about. It's going to be a process, okay? So calmly move forward, okay? Don't worry about it tonight. Get some sleep. It's all right. So, I appreciate everyone's interest in this, and we should all be interested. It's going to take time. So, and your efforts are going to be important. We should be excited about this. We shouldn't be worried about it. We should be hopeful, but we should be patient.
States and locals.
Yes. State and locals, absolutely.
Yes. You just said state.
So, apologies. State and locals. Jill, you said that.
So I'll just add, again, from a jurisdictional perspective, I think you said you use the NEDS-based system, so one of the hopes is that for those of us who are in collectives that are using the same tool, whether it's NEDS-based system or Maven or Atlas or Trisano, that we can collectively come together and solve some of the technical problems around, you know, ingesting case reports into our systems so we don't have to do it alone. And again, I would hope that for the NEDS-based system, a lot of that work would be done as part of the NEDS-based system development. Doesn't solve your onboarding problem, which is a whole other problem.
And I want to piggyback on what Bill and Rita said and mention that in many ways, RCKMS is decreasing the commitment that your staff will need, right? In a lot of ways, it's providing a uniform tool in an environment where traditionally we've each developed our own systems, our own processes, our own data flows, and this is really envisioned to be a tool to help eliminate a lot of that and help jurisdictions uniform.
Rita?
Hi, yeah, I'm Sina Smith from Massachusetts, and I'd like to commend you all on a lovely piece of work. It's really elegant, and I'm quite excited. I have a couple of concerns that I'm hoping this panel is uniquely qualified to address. So, you know, we in Massachusetts have been collecting case reports for some time electronically, and one of the hurdles is that the criteria, we're changing them all the time. You know, it's ongoing. I'd like to say monthly, but we change it and we look at what comes through and we change it, so it's really a continuous process. And I'm hoping that this environment will let people, because I think that's the reality. You know, it's not going to be set your requirements and then readdress them once every 3 or 4 months. I think it's going to be much more hands-on, is my experience. And I'm hoping that this platform, this environment will facilitate that.
So I from the from the tool perspective, it is designed to handle that. So, you know, you, for example, that on that grid, you sort of saw a fixed set of criteria. You know, it's meant to be very easy to make some changes. It's designed to be able to add and remove criteria with sort of the generalized authoring capabilities. And I think we have to maybe work together to figure out how that new authoring criteria, if you were interested in some additional criteria, for example, or logic to be added to your reporting specification, I think that we would want to work with you to figure out how best to do that. Some jurisdictions might just kind of be more hands-off and not really want to get more involved in the details, and then some might say, hey, you know, let me help you author some of that criteria. Maybe we could add it to the tool. From a technical perspective, the software is designed to handle that, but I think that we need to learn how to work together and to be able to make sure that it can be responsive to your needs. More capability could be provided to the jurisdiction that is initially limited and is currently only available to the RCKMS app. We could maybe make some of that additional capability available to the jurisstictions.
Yeah, I know there's a balance between ease of use and
right.
complexity. So it addresses my other concern as well, which is, it's all around the same thing. It's about, it's Jillian's thing, which is always, we're only supposed to look at what we're supposed to look at. And, you know, I think Rita, you addressed it, it's, and so did you, it's not going to be a perfect solution, but it's going to get capture most of what most people need, I think, has been your mantra. And I have some concerns, because my view is that what we're collecting, we try to be as precise as possible, and are we going to lose some of that precision as we work towards getting a tool that everybody can use? And do you see what I'm saying? There's a slight fuzziness about this, and I'm not saying that's a bad thing, but I'm saying that for a lot of states, that's going to be a paradigm shift.
Yes. I think absolutely, and I've heard a lot of people say, are we allowed to receive more than is in our rule? And my answer is allowed by whom? So I think ultimately it comes back to your jurisdictional rules. Certainly, for example, in our jurisdiction, our rule says we get all HIV tests regardless of result and all lead tests regardless of result. So we get positive and negative, but our rule enables that. If we all decided to sort of frame our rules a little more broadly, recognizing all the challenges there, then yes, we would have that legal backing to say, yeah, we might get things that are not sort of narrowly within the scope that we had previously defined. And, you know, I use the word e-shred, but the notion that if we do that second level of screening within our own agency and say, you know, those are really not cases, that's not a case, and we get rid of that in some way. Somebody asked me yesterday whether, how a jurisdictional rule relates to HIPAA, for example. So we get, you know, can we ask our reporters to send a whole bunch of stuff, and are they going to get into trouble if they send things that aren't exactly reportable? Well, we certainly heard a lot of those concerns from both laboratories and from clinical settings. And yesterday, for those of you who are in the session, you know that in our proposed toolkit, we've got a whole section about legal and policy considerations. And I am not a lawyer. I do not play one on TV. And I don't know the answer. But I think the answer should be knowable, and we need to find it out.
Where you go. I like that word. No.
This is titled something about a toolkit for the new frontier, and that's where we are right now. We are in previously uncharted waters.
Hi, Annie Fine from New York City. I also applaud the amount of work that's gone into this. It's fantastic. You guys have done a great job. A couple of concerns that I probably mentioned before. If you take something as simple as like a diagnosis of X in an EHR, and so we don't want any diagnosis of X in an EHR to come to us over and over and over and over. We want the right of it to come to us when it's recent, so the rules for what happens to trigger the report out of the EHR is part of this. Like, I don't feel like I could write offering rules without knowing what are the rules for what is even getting to our CKMS. And that's sort of a black box to me right now, and I feel like you can't really even think about the system without understanding that piece. So I feel it's really important for us at some point to try to understand how is that going to work, and does the actual message, which is the EICR, along with Aaron's amazing work to, you know, make that happen, does that contain enough information for me to say, oh, I only want the ones that are recent. I only want the diagnoses that are associated with a date that is within X number of days, or, you know, associated with an encounter, a recent encounter. All that, those kinds of details are super important for somebody like me who's going to be getting a billion reports. You know, we have to be able to digest them and filter them so we get the ones we want and we don't get drowned and unable to respond to anything. So those are big concerns that I have. That was my one. And my second comment is, what about things that are ambiguous? So if you get something that comes in and the address is erroneous, you have a zip code that's outside New York City and an address that's inside New York City, what's going to happen with that? Is it going to have to go to some kind of human to resolve? How are those going to be, and are we as a jurisdiction going to have input into that kind of decision, which is part of it? It's sort of like the rules behind the rules.
So I'll take a whack at your first one, and it calls to mind, you know, the conundrum of the event date in the case notifications that we provide to CDC. So, you know, there's a little hierarchy of onset date. And, you know, so which date? And if somebody puts a, like you say, a diagnosis on a problem list, or it appears in a billing record, what kind of data information is associated with it? There's certainly in the HL7 artifact plenty of places to put, you know, the effective date of the problem as well as the date that it was recorded in the system. But is that information always available? So that's a really good question, and one that is not solvable necessarily by us. I think that's part of the reason why those of us who can get our hands on some case report, on some CDA documents, are so grateful to be able to see what's there. I mean, it's not always encouraging, but it is always interesting to see not just what the providers are recording, but how the EHR systems are recording it. And, you know, some loss of fidelity where we might expect things to be coded and they're not coded, or we might always expect the date to be there and sometimes it's blank. So I think some of that's going to have to be worked out as we start getting more volumes of this, these. And Sita, you, it sounds like you've got a whole pile that we could look at. So but we will be coming to you to look at that. And I'm going to turn to, I guess, Daryl to answer the second part of that question about how we're going to handle determining the location. Because that's certainly a thorny problem for me, even in my EOR system.
That's a really good question. It's I think it's a part of sort of the broader ECR initiative, and that I will say that I have not been a part of. I think that there are solutions. You know, they're not perfect. I know probably in New York City you probably have some capabilities for dealing with erroneous addresses and things like that. And certainly what I do in my project work is I take from other projects and I like to, you know, apply what I've learned. And I think that is a very good. It often does involve human review. The idea is to limit that as much as possible. I also do think, and I haven't been involved in the trigger code work, but I think, not too much, a little bit, but I think that there has to be some parameters that we can work with the reporters about when to trigger, when not to trigger, maybe for certain conditions, you know, we're interested, you know, going back, you know, a certain amount of time. So to provide a certain amount of data going back from, you know, say a few days or a few months, and I think that should probably be a part of those parameters and worked out. I'm sorry to say I don't have much more information than that.
Can I add one thing? And even though I'm not even part of the panel here, but
yes, you are.
You're sitting here.
It can't be worse than some of the quality of the ELR data that we're getting. So, I mean, you know, in Massachusetts, we're getting over 97% of our data that are coming through ELR, and I can tell you that the quality of the demographic data that are coming in is not stellar, and I totally expect that the data that are going to be coming from the EHR data are going to be orders of magnitude better. So hopefully we will really improve the need for manual review of discrepant address information.
I guess I'd also point out that as we get more automated, there's fewer and fewer problems, right? So there's going to be more problems with somebody filling in by hand a fax form to send to your jurisdiction than there is somebody sending an ELR, than there is somebody sending a CCB of a, or CDA of your, or CDA of your EHR. So I agree that, you know, it's a very relevant concern, and I piggyback on Daryl. I don't know the technical solutions here, but it's definitely things that we need to start thinking about. But the idea is that as we move forward with these solutions, you're going to have fewer and fewer problems than you would have a human doing these processes.
Oh, and I did one last thing I do want to say about the address issue. That is something that the RCKMS team actually will be involved in. That it's not just going to be punted to the jurisdictions or others to figure out, because that is one of the functions of the RCKMS service, is to determine, you know, what are the relevant jurisdictions here based on the patient data or the where the care was received or whatnot. And if we see bad data, then there's also an issue that we need to look at. So maybe we'll be doing the human reviewing.
Well, do you have the authority to do that?
No, not necessarily. So, but a couple of thoughts. One is that I think we've always known that there may be some maybe so answers. It's not necessarily going to be black and white, but yes or no, this is reportable, and it may be at times we have to go back and say, this may be reportable if it meets these conditions in this jurisdiction, or this may be reportable if the jurisdiction is X, if that can't be. So I don't think it's necessarily the only location that could result in an ambiguous response, perhaps. The other thing is that you bring up excellent questions, and they are on the edge of implementation, both for public health and clinical care. And we have known, both from the comments that we got back on the EICR guide, that there were a number of things that were on the edge and out of scope as we determined it for that guide, but critical in need of much discussion with these multiple groups in order to do that. And one thing that's been considered is sort of a companion guide or something. I'm not sure what the correct technical term would be in the standards world, but something that would be used alongside the ERCR guide. Where do you look for these things in your EI, in your EHR? What's the timing? What's the definition of an encounter, which we've learned is different in different settings? And at least what we, you know, can come to a collective agreement of, this is what we think it is for EPR, and apply it how it should be applied in your setting, but this is what we're looking for. You know, quite frankly, we've had mixed reactions to that. Some that says clinical care is going to know what to do, and some that says they want to talk more to us. So I think we need to all get around this table that I think is being set for us to do these things. But we're, you know, there's a lot of discussion that still has to occur.
So I think we've got time for maybe one or two more questions, so please.
Clifford Mitchell from Maryland. So I'm on the environmental health side of the world. You mentioned there are four toxins that are in there. Lead is, I'm assuming, one of them. Carboxyhemoglobin? Anybody, do you know what the other three are?
Janet, you're
Yeah.
Can you speak to the microphone, Janet?
Yeah, pesticides. And so the criteria for pesticides is sort of an illustration. I just wanted to understand the logic of that rule a little bit, because, for example, with some of them, there's sort of fuzzy rules like cholinesterase levels. There's a sort of a degree of, unlike a sort of, if you've got a culture and it's positive, you're fine, but with toxins, it's a slightly different issue with arsenic and cholinesterase and various other things. So I'm just wondering whether or not, and wondering how you sort of approach the idea of that section and toxins particularly, where you've got very, very fuzzy logic sometimes.
My first comment is, I wish you were on our call for that condition.
Yeah.
My second comment is...
And I will volunteer, by the way.
Thank you. I'm sure Janet actually could probably share the spreadsheet with you, and if you want to provide comment, that'd be awesome.
Yeah.
So that's my first comment. The second comment is just that we had a call full of subject matter experts, and I know we had one from Washington, had one from Michigan, another from Minnesota, Alabama. I forget everybody that was on that specific call, but you know, that came up, and we actually needed to get a lot of feedback from jurisdictions on, you know, we really start with the question, what are you asking providers to report now? And then we move, how do you get that to be automated? And so I don't know the specific answers for that, but we really do, that's why we have that content vetting process, is we really do need the subject matter experts like yourself. And
so the occupational health group would be happy to volunteer at CSPD to I'm volunteering then, but we'd actually be happy to help you.
Thank you so much, Clifford. But I think you're exactly right, and I think I really want to highlight that that's why we have that content vetting process, because we don't know those answers up here. You know, we really need people like Clifford and other subject matter experts to help us through those questions. And we do have seven more conditions to go through if you want to help us out.
Hi, Jennifer Wardot, work with the Vendor Supporting Advocates. Just a question, I don't expect the answers to it, but are folks thinking about the onboarding process and kind of how that will work if you're using the shared services, and if you're working with a hospital in your jurisdiction who maybe is able to receive ECR, but you onboard them and the jurisdiction that the case should go to is not able to receive ECR, and sort of all of those things and the validation process that typically happens with EOR, I don't know if that will need to happen with case reporting as well, but if so, who's responsible for that and kind of how all that will work?
I'll answer quick and then I'll hand it to Laura. The answer is yes, we're thinking about it. We don't have answers yet. Clearly, as I mentioned, onboarding, even if, you know, we've got this wonderful platform and we've got all this national infrastructure and we've got these great tools, getting individual institutions to send case reports and do it correctly is, as we know from ELR, a huge task. And no matter, you know, the level of centralization of some of the infrastructure, it's still going to fall to the jurisdictions to bring their local providers on board and do whatever validation is necessary. So that was part of our toolkit discussion yesterday. It's clearly an important topic, and we've got to flesh it out and figure out how that's going to work, particularly those cross-jurisdictional issues. Now, some of those, you know, there's some very interesting projects going on for ELR for cross-jurisdictional exchange, and I think we can learn from that in terms of how we facilitate some of you know, solutions to those problems.
Well, you can talk about it. I'm just not the commercial.
Well, I wanted to, but the informatics fellow from Washington in the next breakout sessions, and I don't know if it's in this room or not, but is one of the next
boardroom downstairs.
Okay,
boardroom.
Thank you, Janet. But we'll be reviewing a project that they're working on, where they are getting CDAs from a clinical partner and doing review of that and data quality and lessons learned there. So I don't know the details. I just was excited to see it on the agenda.
Go ahead,
Jana Hamilton from Florida, and I guess first I just want to say I think other people have said that I really commend this work and I'm really excited about it. And when I put on my CSTE hat and thinking about, you know, the spectrum of this activity, I love RCKMS and I think about how important it is. When I put on my Florida hat, then I start asking questions about, and for some of you I've made these comments through the meeting, so some of the things that I would really need to know, for example, if it breaks, who do I call, who's supporting me after hours? And, you know, when we did this for electronic laboratory reporting, we just all made those decisions individually. And I think in some states, we probably made good decisions, and in other states, maybe we made okay decisions. But we all have that individual ownership, and I think we understand it. In varying degrees, and now when we talk about using shared infrastructure, you know, that's that leap of faith of giving up some of that control and ownership And then I think also this big concept about trust. And so I'm just wondering, as we move down this path together, which I think we really need, how we can try to bridge that gap and what kinds of conversations are going on within the RCKMS world so that when, you know, people like me go back to our state and talk about how are we going to do this, we have some more questions and answers to be able to talk with our IT people and others about how we're really going to do this stuff. And I say that in part also just to recognize that, you know, we really haven't actually done this kind of thing before, and I think we've talked about it a lot, so it's exciting, but a little bit intimidating too.
Can I speak to that just really quickly? Because that was actually one of my questions, was around governance, and I think that there is perhaps some lessons that can be learned by the pilot we're doing with CDC on Quest, using AIMS as the platform and having Quest data report through ELR, and perhaps we can answer some of those questions on a smaller scale to apply that for our RCKMS governorship going forward. That was just a thought I had. But I too have those concerns around governance, and I was wondering if you could sort of build upon what Janet was saying and comment around what that structure would look like.
Can I just say one thing? I think it's a little different than governance. I think governance is part of it. But, I'm agreeing with Janet as always.
Thanks, Rita.
I think there's at least three threads embedded in that recent conversation for me. One is clearly the G word, the governance word, and it's around content governance and also governance of the tooling in terms of what features get added. Daryl was saying, you know, does this feature that now is in the administrative tool set get moved over to the general user tool set? So those are governance questions, and I think we can learn from other experiences. The BioSense experience is another one where there was a, you know, collaborative national governance effort for, you know, but I won't make any comments. the second question is the support of a really high-throughput national platform. And I personally, and I know that it's heretical in some circles, but I'm going to go there. I personally like to separate RCKMS per se from the question of the shared infrastructure, because they are separable. And Daryl said it, I said it. RCKMS can live on its own, and it can generate knowledge that can be consumed by reporters completely independent of whether it lives on a shared platform. There are advantages to living on a shared platform. We can talk about what they are. But RCKMS does not require the existence of a shared platform for all the rest of the pieces of ECR, for example, or ELR. If we do commit to a shared platform, then all the questions that you raised are absolutely front and center. I mean, are we going to be able to scale the way we hope we will? What kind of support and what kind of sustainability? I mean, we've all had the experience of, you know, being part of big projects that sounded great and maybe got a fair distance and then kind of petered out because the ongoing support didn't exist. Anybody remember the public health grid? Sorry. So those are the three buckets that I would put those three concerns in.
I think we need to be respectful of everybody's time, but I want to say one more thing. Janet and Julie up here at the front have one pagers that have some information if you want to grab those before you leave.
I do want to give a shout out to our panel here, so thank you very much for this great conversation.